There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
We're in Plan Z now, it seems like, but that's the way this goes sometimes. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to an important episode 165 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's April 9th, 2010. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. This week, West Virginia worry, seismic events, and the coal mine explosion. Reverend Billy's holy hex and mountaintop removal. WikiLeaks, collateral murder, and the future of journalism. Oregon oddities, police state updates, bio wars, and 9/11 remains. All that and so much more on this power-packed April 9th, 2010, episode 165 of MediaMonarchy.com.
So I decided to run away. What could I do? Where could I go if I showed them?
disturb those fields of coal, for they may turn to gold. And if they break you, don't let them run away with your soul. The song is called Fields of Coal by the appropriately titled And You Will Know Us by the Trail of Dead. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 165 of Media Monarchy. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com. And it's April 9th, 2010, just after 10 a.m. West Coast time, broadcasting live on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Simulcasting live on ZeroPointRadio.com, as well as their feeds out to 92.3 FM and 1670 AM in Casper, Wyoming. Simulcasting live on the worldwide home of free speech, revereradio.net. LaughlinRadio.com is our newest live affiliate. Huge thanks to those guys down in Laughlin, Nevada. LaughlinRadio.com. 98.5 FM. Free Radio Olympia, frolympia.org, replays Media Monarchy for you. As well, 104.1 FM in Berkeley, California, berkeleyliberationradio.net. 93.9 FM in Boulder, Colorado, phantomradio.org. 90.7 FM, KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, thanks to oneskyradio.com. 87.9 FM in Canton, Georgia, thanks to stickam.com/groundzeroradio. And Glenn at CascadiaPublicRadio.org makes Media Monarchy, as well as a whole host of amazing alternative media news shows for you at a smaller bitrate and file size. And on the opposite end, my man Jeff from Radio23.org supplies the high-quality episodes of Media Monarchy that you can get at feeds.feedburner.com/MediaMonarchyHD. And we can all get in touch and share ideas on Facebook.com/MediaMonarchy, MySpace.com/MediaMonarchy, Twitter, YouTube, Yahoo, Gmail, Skype, Instant Messenger, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org. Radio for All is struggling. We like to have the redundancies. And I recently donated some money to help keep Radio for All going, using some of the generous donations given to Media Monarchy in the past month as part of our distribution of the new documentary 2020 Hindsight Censorship on the Front Line from Richard Andrew Grove, TragedyAndHope.com, and Divergent Films. I know my man Damon up in Olympia, Washington has gotten his copy. Everyone who's donated so far to Media Monarchy has received their DVD of 2020 Hindsight. And if you haven't donated, I still implore you. Your support helps alternative media grow and survive. And of course, broadcasting live, we welcome you wherever you are in the world, however you're listening or re-listening. Again, my name's James. I've been doing the site and show for nearly 5 years. The events of 9/11 were what woke me up to want to investigate what was really going on in the world. And it's so much deeper than just that. We're nonpartisan here, nonviolent, anti-war, pro-personal liberties. We don't buy in to the phony left-right paradigm. It's a divide-and-conquer dialectic they've been using for a long, long time. And again, multi-generational families and organizations and corporations that owe no allegiance to any nation or flag or God, but they use all those things to play all of us against each other. When we're doing this show live, we, of course, always like to leave the Google News page up to see what's going on in the world as we're broadcasting live again on this April 9th, 2010, episode 165.
talking about. James David Manning, yeah, had him on about a year ago. So he's definitely carrying the torch, and I hope more people of color, more African Americans, begin to speak out. But there's a lot of intimidation tactics that people use in their own circle to intimidate people. Oh, you're talking bad about Obama. You know, I had some fool call my TV show last week. Why are you talking bad about Obama? Why are you talking bad about... I'll tell you why I'm talking bad about Obama. You retard. 9/11 was an inside job. We're still slaves to the military-industrial complex. The banker got $28 trillion. What's wrong with you, dumbass? What, your mommy, like, dropping you intentionally on your head repeatedly as a small child? What is your malfunction?
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
U.S. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens is retiring. That means Obama will have a Supreme Court appointment to make. Kyrgyz president accused of looting. We, of course, have massive protests in Kyrgyzstan. Martial law in Thailand. All that going on all around the world. And again, there's... I can't recall who said it off the top of my head, but it's the birth pains of the New World Order. And people all around the world, I believe, are having a larger awakening. And we're at a really pivotal point. I'm not hiding away in a bunker, but things are getting pretty serious. And things are kind of escalating. And everybody knows that, and you can feel it. Keeping me up at night. So, as I said at the very top, this is an important episode of Media Monarchy. They're all important. They keep myself and hopefully you and everybody out there up to date. I try and give you the text and the context and the subtext. Lay out the path so you can do more research. And the more I learn, the more I know I don't know. And all we're trying to do is shine a light on the shadows cast on the wall of the cave. Why this episode is important to me, longtime listeners may know this. New listeners may not, and again, I welcome you all. I've been in Portland, Oregon for not quite 5 years, but I was born and raised in southern West Virginia. Was in Fayetteville for 18 years and then moved to the Eastern Panhandle in a cool town called Shepherdstown. Lived there for another decade where I was the music director at my college community radio station, WSHC. Just a stone's throw away from Maryland, closer to the capital. So the recent West Virginia mine blast basically happened 30 plus miles from where I'm from. And I've got a bit of coverage, of course, on this story that kind of literally hits me where I live, and what is ultimately a small story that is going to involve small communities' pain and how it relates to the wider issues all around the world, just like we're talking about. Everybody kind of having this feeling of something. We don't know if it's good or bad or what it's going to be. and we're all rubbing our eyes and saying, I'm starting to see what's going on. So it affects the larger national and international energy policy and so much more, and how we're going to keep moving in the 21st century. So needless to say, this story affects me on a personal level. I don't know any of the people involved in this personally, not that I know of. But again, looking at the names, I recognize some last names as just recognizable last names. And I've got something really cool and exclusive for you in just a little bit. But let's break this down for folks. Posted on MediaMonarchy.com under West Virginia Worry. 25 plus killed in Massey coal mine explosion. 25 dead in West Virginia mine blast is the worst since 1984. Reading an early report from the Associated Press going back to Monday. A huge underground explosion blamed on methane gas killed 25 miners in the worst U.S. coal mining disaster since 1984, and rescuers on Tuesday began a dangerous and possibly futile attempt to rescue four others still missing. Crews were bulldozing an access road so they could drill 1,000 feet into the earth to release gases and make it safe to try and find the missing miners. They were feared dead after the Monday afternoon blast at a mine with a history of violations for not properly ventilating highly combustible methane. Rescuers were being held back by poison gases that accumulated near the blast site, about a mile and a half from the entrance to Massey Energy Company's sprawling Upper Big Branch mine. They had to create an access road above it before they could begin drilling four shafts to release methane and carbon monoxide. Governor Joe Manchin said at a news briefing Tuesday that it could be Wednesday night before the first hole is drilled, saying, quote, it's a slow process. It's just going to be a slow process. Now again, this initial report from the Associated Press goes back to Tuesday, Monday and Tuesday. Here we are, 4 days later, on Friday, and we look at the breaking news right now, and not much has changed. It's been a back and forth, try to go in and then back out because it's become much too dangerous. Just looking at the most recent right now, the Washington Post, mine disaster highlights politics of coal in West Virginia. House and Senate to hold hearings on the mining explosion. And of course, Massey to review the deadly West Virginia mine blast. Among the myriad things that are contained in this post, and again, I try and give you all the links. We won't hear the clip on this episode, but you can see the head of Massey Energy, Don Blankenship, a man of almost cartoonish, supervillainous proportions, as if he literally looks like someone who would twirl his mustache and tie a damsel to the train tracks. So I put together a few clips to hopefully break this situation down. And again, we're going to go into all the updates. And again, the exclusive interview that I have for you concerning the West Virginia mine blast.
Now described as possibly the worst U.S. mine accident in more than 25 years, mining company Massey Energy says 25 workers have been killed in an explosion inside a southern West Virginia coal mine. The explosion is believed to have been caused by leaking methane gas rocking the mine Monday afternoon. As word of the explosion spread, loved ones raced to the scene.
I just started getting all these phone calls. They told me that they asked me if Kevin was working the evening or night. That's all he said. And when I told him the evening, they told me there'd been an explosion. We really just came to pray because we don't have immediate family in the mine. But we know some of the people that work here. Our pastor works at this mine.
Four other miners are still unaccounted for, but for the time being, rescue work at the mine has been halted.
We needed to make sure the safety of our rescue teams was of utmost importance to all of us, and we asked them to retreat.
The cause of the blast remains unknown. Miners were leaving on a vehicle that takes them in and out of the mine's long shaft. when a crew ahead of them felt a blast of air and went back to investigate. The mine is located about 30 miles south of Charleston and has a history of violations for not properly ventilating highly combustible methane gas. The mine is equipped with airtight chambers stocked with food, water, and enough oxygen for miners to live up to 4 days.
You know, it's unfortunate that every mine safety law we have on the books today has been written with the blood of our coal miners.
Last year, the number of miners killed on the job in the U.S. fell for a second straight year to 34, the fewest since officials began keeping records nearly a century ago.
I want to send my deepest condolences, our thoughts and prayers to the families and the friends of the workers who lost their lives after an explosion took place in a West Virginia mine yesterday. At this moment, there are still people missing. There are rescue teams that are searching tirelessly and courageously to find them. I spoke with Governor Manchin of West Virginia last night and told him that the federal government stands ready to offer whatever assistance is needed in this rescue effort. So I would ask for the faithful who gathered here this morning to pray for the safe return of the missing, the men and women who put their lives on the line to save them, and the souls of those who have been lost in this tragic accident. May they rest in peace, and may their families find comfort in the hard days ahead.
C.C. Ballard is retired, but he spent more than 30 years in the coal mines. Now he has to walk with a cane, and he even lost a finger, torn apart by a machine underground. But he says mining is a good job.
Anytime you go underground, you've got all the rock and the dirt and stuff over you. It's dangerous, but if you're going to make any money, you go in the mines.
Jerry works at the gas station, but his son works in the mine. He was not hurt in the explosion, but still, danger is always on everybody's mind here.
It's hard on everybody, even if you ain't got nobody up there, you know, because a lot of these boys we know and growed up with. So, yeah. It's just one of them things that happens.
The overall safety of the mine is now in question, and some in the media are very critical. But many here would rather hide their tears, and almost no one dares to criticize the company that keeps the town alive. Local activists are more vocal. Julia Bounce is the daughter of a coal miner, so for her too, the tragedy is hard to accept. But she says everybody knew there were high concentrations of dangerous gases on the ground.
I had heard that there was some methane buildup in this mine about 3 years ago as well. So it's no secret that there was methane in that mine.
Down the road, the church is open for whoever needs support. Sitting on the steps, the pastor says people are used to this.
It just keeps happening. People just accept it because it's just a way of life.
The inquiry will determine the exact causes of the accident and the possible responsibilities. But whatever the authorities say, the people of Mount Cole knew they will need the mining jobs to feed their families.
Now the last part of that clip comes from France 24. And then, of course, we heard Obama speaking before that and the Associated Press report. So again, this story goes all around the world. And I think it probably serves to give me empathy to all those other stories around the world that I don't have some kind of connection to, that again I report on, but can't do it justice, and can't give all the stories and all the events going on around the world the emotional heft they need and should have. So that was, like I said, France 24. We have BBC 34 minutes ago, Hope Fades for West Virginia Mine Survivors. And again, as I said, the initial report that we have up on MediaMonarchy.com is now 3-4 days old, and the situation hasn't changed. We do have an interesting bit of related updates at the bottom of this post, where we'll start it off with a fascinating story by way of Fox News. Seismic events recorded not far from mine disaster site. Two seismic events, one natural, the other man-made, occurred not far from where West Virginia coal mine just days before a suspected methane explosion left at least 25 miners dead and 4 missing. An earthquake registering magnitude 3.4 occurred early Sunday morning about 100 miles northeast of Montcoal, West Virginia, the location of the Upper Big Branch mine. An earthquake of that magnitude is strong enough to dislodge pockets of methane gas, though the distance from the mine suggested it wouldn't have affected the explosion. There's the definite possibility that that's what could have happened, but not from this earthquake. This one was too far away and day separated. That makes a big difference, says Julie Dutton, geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Fascinating connection. And it goes on, coal, corruption, and campaign finance reform. More on that from Ezra Klein on Washington Post blog. Mine Safety Agency issued report warning of poor inspector training 5 days before West Virginia explosion. More on this from allgov.com. Only 5 days before the worst mining accident in more than 25 years, the federal government's Mine Safety and Health Administration was faulted for not doing a better job of training inspectors. An investigation by the U.S. Department of Labor Inspector General found, with a PDF link for you, again, that's what we try and do on the show. If there's a report, if there's research, if there's video, audio, we try and bring that to you. An investigation by the Department of Labor's Inspector General found that while MSHA had increased its number in training of inspectors, more than half had not undergone mandatory training. Fascinatingly enough, again, as I said, this maybe gives empathy. Because on the other side of the world, a similar situation is playing out. Rescuers race to find missing and flooded China mine. Rescuers were searching Tuesday for 32 workers still trapped in a flooded Chinese coal mine as the joy of seeing over 100 others pulled out alive was tempered by the first news of fatalities. Will Congress take on coal mining companies? Asks Christian Science Monitor. West Virginia leads the battle against the EPA over mountaintop mining regulations. And again, as this is playing out on an emotional level, we know it's all leading to a more political and social conversation that's going to have to take place very soon. As this week's deadly mining explosion in West Virginia and the rescue attempt of four workers keep the nation on edge, a lesser-known battle is taking place here and in other Appalachian states with Washington over mountaintop mining practices. As the nation follows the story, the EPA has announced much tougher standards for water quality at mountaintop mining sites effective immediately. Doug Scaff, Democratic state lawmaker, warns it will hurt the coal industry and cost jobs in tough economic times. Nobody really understands the impact that coal has here in West Virginia, Scaff said. It gives back to the schools, it gives back to the communities, it gives back to the infrastructure of the state. Reuters reports, U.S. mine blast firm lacks on safety, says former miners for Massey Energy. And one of the best sources I found to kind of follow this, again, as this plays out, is a blog on the Charleston Gazette's website, wvgazette.com/coaltattoo. And the latest they have there, Massey CEO Don Blankenship tells his company's shareholders that media reports that safety lapses led to mine disaster are, quote, completely unfounded. Representative Shelley Moore Capito urges a hard look at the close relationship between coal operators and the MSHA. Massey Mine had unabated violations at the time of Monday's explosion. Will anyone, Manchin or Obama, hold a public hearing on the Massey Energy Mine disaster? That's the interesting situation, my friends. Coal being the integral part of the state and the economy and the history of West Virginia. You have a corporation obviously corrupt and neglect and derelict in their duties, cheap and dirty. And the money doesn't even go back to the state as much as it goes to ultimately offshore. And we're going to have to get into Massey Energy more. And again, I can't do it all here. There's no way. And I don't have the answer. And I'll say that again and again. The more I learn, the more I know I don't know, and I don't have the answer to this situation and how it relates to the larger environmental, national, international energy policy and beyond. And again, we'll stay on the breaking news to see if anything happens as we're doing this episode 165 for you. But the way I want to close out the first part of our coverage of West Virginia worry, seismic events, and the coal mine explosion is something I never thought I'd have, and something I'm really excited to be able to share with you guys. And I'll do it very simply, and we'll get right to it. My dad is employed by the state of West Virginia. He has an extensive background in the coal industry as an independent businessman back in the late 70s. He has been on the scene in Montcoal, West Virginia since late Monday night, back and forth, not much sleep. I got him on Skype Wednesday, and we had about a half-hour conversation. I've boiled it down to its essence. And so I'm happy to play this for you, my friends. This is me and my dad talking about the West Virginia coal mining explosion.
Well, let me just simply say that within the mining industry, this was an underground mining explosion. It was actually a horrific mining explosion that was ignited. Has not been identified the ignition, but it was a methane explosion. And it was very, very devastating to the mines underground. And there were the folks that have passed at this point were 25 coal miners. It was during what's called shift change. It was going from day shift to evening shift around the 3 o'clock, 3:30 range. The day shift people were coming out. The evening shift people were coming in. And that's when the explosion took place. It's actually, if you can picture just a blast of hot air as well as flames shooting through a tunnel, basically is what happened. There's no explanation of how or why at this point.
Well, and we know that it's just been over 4 years since the Sago mine disaster.
Well, let me explain. Sago mine disaster was when the governor of West Virginia just came on board as his first term. It was something that he dealt with, I think, very, very diligently, as best he could. It was something that took place in January. He took the office in November. So it was very, very difficult to get adjusted, I think.
In November of 2005, correct?
That is correct, yes. No, he was elected in 2004. He came into office January of 2005. Yeah, and so within that year, 2006 of January, that's when the Sago took place, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, so West Virginia and Governor Joe Manchin actually initiated the effort of instituting new laws through the state of West Virginia, as well as the federal people have agreed to improve the availability of men that may be trapped underground to be in a safe chamber. It's called a rescue chamber. That there's 96 hours of air, food, water supply that men can, when they have an issue of emergency, to retreat to a mine safety chamber. This explosion was so rapid, so quickly, that the chambers are in place for the miners to retreat to. But if you, again, if you can picture the immediate response of a flame that blows instantaneously, the men may not have had an opportunity to retreat to the chambers, which is more so it happens that they can than they can't. And then under this situation, they possibly could not have. There are seven men that were actually coming out of the mines trying to get out, and the blast literally overcame where they were in what's called a man trip. It's like a little bus on a rail that brings people out and into the coal mines. And these seven men were the first seven that died that they identified. So the rescue people went in and they began to what they call proof of mine, meaning go through section by section, 1,000 feet, whatever, 100 feet. They go through section by section, making sure that everything is clear to continue to move on to do rescue. And they hours later found four additional miners that had passed away. they're trained through Mine Rescue to do triage immediately. But if indeed the individual has expired, they move on to look for survivors. So there are now, as we speak, there are 7 miners that have been extracted from the mines physically. There has been 18 miners now that have been confirmed dead that have not been physically removed and or identified. The concentration now is on the 4 coal miners that they cannot confirm alive or dead. And that is near where the mining process takes place, what they call the face. And that's the most dangerous area. Now, whether the blast took place there is not known. They have drilled a hole to relieve the air to get the methane gas out of the mines so that new fresh air can be relieved and the rescue people can get back in. The rescue people were called out yesterday, which would have been Tuesday, because it was so dangerous, the levels of methane and CO2 that would have exploded and caused more deaths. So they retreated. They drilled a hole. It's there. They're ventilating now. And as soon as the air becomes breathable, so to speak, in layman's terms, the rescue teams will immediately go back in to see where the additional 4 miners are. 300 feet approximately from the drill hole where the ventilation is taking place, that's where one of the rescue chambers exists. We are hoping, as a state of West Virginia, that those 4 miners were able to retreat to this chamber where there is indeed 96 hours of air, food, water, supply. There's plenty of time if those men literally made it into that supply chamber. So that's the hope of these families. Most of them know that their loved one could be deceased, but hoping that one of the 4 could indeed be their loved one that is still alive. And that's where we are.
And we're, I guess, just over halfway through that 96 hours here again as we speak on Wednesday night.
That's correct.
Now, you have essentially been on the scene there since, you know, at least in a few hours after this event took place on Monday.
Well, let me simply say that the state of West Virginia is protecting the families away from the mainstream media.
Okay.
There's a three mile distance between the national media briefing situations versus where the family is. And the state of West Virginia, the federal mine people, and the company briefs the family prior to briefing the nation.
Okay.
Or the world. Okay? They get the honest information, and the media gets the honest information next. They respect the family. They've requested that the national media leave the courtesy of leaving the privacy of the family to grieve on their own. And I've been assigned by the state of West Virginia to be with the families. It's called the Family Center, which includes immediate family, partially extended families, which could be cousins, sisters, that kind of thing. So there is, there's a private area which is secured by the state of West Virginia through the state police. They are protecting the families from that situation. Now, I want to also say that there are 2 individuals that have that came out of the mines that were placed into hospitals. So we have 2 people that were in hospitals. One is still in guarded, critical, so to speak, condition. The other individual is in good condition, and it should be released within the next day. The West Virginia State Police will be securing that family so that they are not bombarded with mainstream media. The governor's trust, thought, and mindset is protect the families, because when the national media is gone, the families will remain together. He's assigned staff members to be with the families day in and day out. And to answer your question, I was notified the explosion apparently took place around 3 to 4 o'clock. I was notified around 5:30. I was on the scene by 7 p.m. that night, and have received about 9 hours of rest between that time, and it's now Wednesday evening. at 10:15 West Virginia time.
And again, I really appreciate you taking time to do this. And I guess I've always believed in a way that, you know, I've always, you know, had huge pride in West Virginia, even more so being in Oregon for the last 5 years, that, again, an event of this magnitude is going to bring a lot more attention, not only to West Virginia, but to, you know, coal mining in general, and just some of the practices, and of course, just how it affects, you know, the national energy policy. So I suppose that, you know, in a way, if this could be used to, you know, have more progressive measures and safety measures, you know, come about, that in a way, you know, maybe, you know, West Virginia can be a, you know, a catalyst for, you know, a much larger discussion on this issue.
Well, and I'll give you my thought, which I believe that the governor of the state of West Virginia believes in, is that he wants what's best for our people, and if it's unsafe, he wants it to be safe. But he does not want the state or the federal government or the news media to twist what truly is West Virginia in totality mindset with we want to do what's right. Circumstances and spiritual powers, whether it's of an act of God or whatever, West Virginia's attitude, and I'm saying the governor of the state of West Virginia attitude is we want to do what's right. Don't blame us for doing our work. This is our life. And he believes in the people of West Virginia. I can honestly repeat that. He loves the people of West Virginia, and they love him for being who he is as a leader in West Virginia. Energy is important to the world. West Virginia is a major player in that. Is coal going to be a major player all the time? We have, and the governor has signed a bill December the 9th, that is a portfolio which includes wind and solar and hydro and trans fuels and all of the peripheral energy availabilities, the renewables that could be there. We want to be, and the governor would say he wants to be a part of all that. But don't cut your nose off to spite your face, basically, is where it's at. You're not going to change the coal industry to be a perfect world. It is what it is and has been for years. And, Jim, your grandfather spent four years in mines. And I know that.
Mm-hmm.
The mining 40 years ago is way technologically advanced beyond digging it by hand and sucking coal dirt in your lungs.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that way anymore. And we have advanced far beyond that. The technology of what the coal industry has right now. And I can honestly say this, this is the most regulated industry in the nation. The only regulated industry, very, very rigorously. Think about the natural gas explosion that took place at the power plant, I'm thinking in Massachusetts or somewhere, 6 people or 8 people died. It was not even on the blip, but for a 24-hour period. That you let a mining disaster or a mining issue come up, whether it's mountaintop removal, underground mining, it is a major, major issue. And you can't deny that. It's the coal industry is being attacked. How can you take 51% of your electricity and the power being supplied by fossil fuels immediately away? Our governor has said, let's balance it. Let's work over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years to get where we need to be. He doesn't deny that. You know, that's what I admire about him. So, it's not just coal, and we hate you and that kind of thing. There's a working mentality here. But the outside world doesn't understand this is our life in West Virginia.
My friends, that was an exclusive interview between me and my father. On the scene all this week in Montcoal at the West Virginia mining explosion. And again, I don't have the answers to all of these things. But it's a discussion we're going to have very soon. And even now, I look at the breaking news 20 minutes ago from the New York Times. After West Virginia mine deaths, how much political trouble is the coal industry in? Now, as a sort of part two to our discussion on West Virginia worry, seismic events, and the coal mine explosion, an amazing article. Huge thanks and hat tips to my man Zach from right here in Portland for sending me this story by way of Courthouse News as well as the Huffington Post. Reverend Billy placed holy hex on J.P. Morgan over West Virginia mountaintop removal. A New York City preacher was arrested after placing a holy hex on J.P. Morgan, protesting what he calls J.P. Morgan's financing for mountaintop removal in Appalachia. Reverend Billy Talon led his Church of Life After Shopping congregation in an Easter morning protest outside of a bank branch in New York City. Reverend Billy led his Life After Shopping gospel choir to two East Village Chase branches where the singers deposited mounds of sacred dirt from Coal River Mountain, West Virginia, onto the floors of ATM lobbies. At the branch on St. Mark's Place and 2nd Avenue, the choir performed a mystery channeling of money as bank customers withdrew money, and the reverend slash performance artist preached to a crowd through a white megaphone. The bank's financing of mountaintop removal, the controlled deforestation and detonation of upper parts of mountains to access coal deposits, has been widely criticized by environmental advocates. In the past two decades, J.P. Morgan has underwritten 20 huge bond deals to help support the practice, Mother Jones noted last month. On Reverend Talon's website, RevBilly.com, he lays out his case against the banksters. Quote, "We're joining thousands of activist citizens who have opposed the removal of peaks in Appalachia for dirty coal mining. In resisting consumerism, there is always an earth justice motive right in front of us. We remember leading Iceland citizens into their own super malls to oppose the big dams and aluminum smelters. We recall opposing the super ferry in Kauai and also singing to tree sitters up in the Redwoods." So again, all the news, all the documentation, Huffington Post, Courthouse News, videos on YouTube, and more blog entries from RevBilly.com. Let's listen to just a brief few exciting moments of Reverend Billy's protest and placing of the holy hex on J.P. Morgan over West Virginia mountaintop removal.
We can do something now, and I ask our friends from the New York Police Department, who are making a living from our taxes, in we ask the police to join the rest of us in pulling our money out of J.P. Morgan Chase. Hallelujah! The resurrection track. The mountains that have had their summits removed. The mountains that have been exploded by J.P. Morgan's money. They will rise again. Hallelujah! Mountain, we're leaving in the lobby.
Thank you.
Message says, CEO Jamie Dimon, if you pull your billions out of dirty coal, if you stop supporting climate change, if you start supporting communities, you can retire a beloved beggar. Is that an oxymoron?
Yes. Amen. Amen.
We'll put it on the back.
Put it on the back. Well, when the mountain comes there again, oh, what a bomb to be on the mountain. When the mountain comes there again, oh, what a bomb to be on the mountain. When the mountain comes again, oh, when the mountain comes back again, oh, when the mountain comes back again.
The amazing satirical cutting performance art, culture jamming, monkey wrenching the New World Order, if you will, of Reverend Billy and the Church of Life after shopping. Moments after that clip ends, he was told to remove the dirt from the ATMs. He refused and was peacefully arrested. Now, we do have a couple of flashback links going all the way back to April of 2007 on MediaMonarchy.com. Shopocalypse Now. And also December of that year in 07, asking the question, what would Jesus buy? Of course, that being the title of the documentary about Reverend Billy. And my friends, a positive way to wrap up this first hour and to wrap up our coverage of seismic events and the coal mine explosion that, again, hits me where I live. I can proudly announce to you right now, just confirmed mere moments ago, Media Monarchy will be interviewing Reverend Billy this Tuesday, my friends, and we're going to dive right in to J.P. Morgan and the banksters in West Virginia and mountaintop removal. So excited. And again, more on that and more on all their great work, RevBilly.com. Now, I was going to bring another song to perhaps exit us out of our coal coverage, but I didn't think I'd have time. We still have so much more massive seismic news, alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups to go over on this episode 165 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's April 9th, 2010. My name's James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com, as well as FoodWorldOrder.com and CyberspaceWar.com. Broadcasting live from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org, ZeroPointRadio.com, RevereRadio.net, and LaughlinRadio.com. And again, a huge thanks to FROlympia.org, Berkeley Free Radio, Phantom Radio, One Sky Radio, Ground Zero Radio, Cascadia Public Radio, Radio 23, and all our great affiliates. And so now, my friends, we're going to shift gears and cover one of the other massive seismic stories of the past week. And again, we were prepping this in at least the week before on Media Monarchy. And it happened. We cover the Reverend Billy protests, as well as the court decision against the FCC, with Comcast emerging the victor. We covered those stories on the most recent New World Next Week with CorbettReport.com, as well as this story. And it happened. It was unleashed this past Monday, April 5th. We knew it was coming, and I speculated that there could be other events that would maybe take some of the spotlight away from this story. And I suppose you could say that the West Virginia mining story did that. But ultimately, the WikiLeaks release of video of civilians killed by U.S. in Baghdad, collateral murder, has gone viral. The story will not go away. We're going to get into it, but this is, as disgusting as it is, the future of journalism. And that's why alternative sites, alternative media, such as WikiLeaks.org, are so important. And again, this story is cross-posted on Media Monarchy as well as Cyberspace War. On April 5th, appearing at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., co-founder of WikiLeaks appeared, and they have set up an entire site called CollateralMurder.com. It contains the videos in multiple forms, multiple redundancies, transcripts, timelines, photos, all of it documented. What are we talking about? Reading from CollateralMurder.com, WikiLeaks has released a classified U.S. military video depicting the indiscriminate slaying of over a dozen people in the Iraqi suburb of New Baghdad, including two Reuters news staff. Reuters had been trying to obtain the video through the Freedom of Information Act without success since the time of the attack. The video, shot from an Apache helicopter gunsight, clearly shows the unprovoked slaying of a wounded reporter, Reuters employee, rather, and his rescuers. The video, shot from an Apache helicopter gunsight, clearly shows the unprovoked slaying of a wounded Reuters employee and his rescuers. Two young children involved in the rescue were also seriously wounded. The military did not reveal how the Reuters staff were killed and stated that they did not know how the children were injured. Again, CollateralMurder.com has two versions of this video. The short version is 18 minutes long. The full version is 38 plus minutes long. And you can read, again, for yourself, the disgusting transcript. And we're going to get into the comparisons between modern warfare and video games, yes. And we have all the links and all of the updates. But there's a massive clip, and it's available from Raw Replay. And they just have it posted up, which was already grabbing enough, under the headline of Retired Intelligence Officer Says U.S. Violated Rules in Reuters Shooting. The retired intelligence officer is Anthony Schaefer, who you might recall being involved in Able Danger, the controversial program that uncovered Mohammed Atta pre-9/11. So in a way, Raw Replay buries the lead because this video comes from MSNBC, and it's the Dylan Radigan Show, which again, I believe, over the last several weeks, never heard of this guy before, but seems to be a strong voice, and again, I don't want any leader. And yes, it's coming from the Microsoft General Electric Corporation, but sometimes you gotta take good news and good work and good leaks when and where and how you can get them. This clip is 17 minutes long and has Anthony Schaefer as well as the aforementioned WikiLeaks co-founder, whose name is Julian Assange. And in all the other clips that we have, Russia Today, Associated Press, BBC, Al Jazeera, all around the world, and again, this story has gone viral. It was not covered up. It won't be covered up. I think this Radigan clip puts it all into perspective, my friends. WikiLeaks releases Collateral Murder.
We are dealing with some newly released and extraordinarily graphic combat video of brutal civilian death in Iraq. The website WikiLeaks says that the classified video is from a U.S. Apache helicopter, engaged in an 07 combat mission. We warn you that the video we are about to show you is disturbing and graphic.
According to WikiLeaks, this video dates to July 12, 2007. It shows two men WikiLeaks identifies as Reuters journalist Namir Nur el-Din and his driver, as well as several others. Namir's camera strap is audibly mistaken for a weapon. He and another man are thought to be equipped with RPGs and AK-47s. The Reuters journalist, his driver, and the other men assemble, and the helicopter opens fire.
Light them all up.
Two traffic, 260.
Come on, fire.
The tape identifies approximately eight men as killed in the strikes, including the Reuters cameraman and his driver. They are apparently assumed to be insurgents. Later, a family and neighbors, adults and children inside a minivan, pull up on the wounded to try to help. They, too, are fired upon.
Come on. Clear.
While the well-being of the adults in the van has not been reported, the two children in the van were seriously wounded. Until now, the military had said it didn't know how those children were injured and that the people killed were anti-Iraqi forces or insurgents. Near the end of the tape, ground troops arrive on the scene, at which point a tank drives over one of the dead bodies.
altogether 12 people are believed to have been killed in that particular series of events. We should point out that the information that we do have right now is from WikiLeaks, which is a group known for leaking sensitive government and corporate documents, which in the past have proven to be authentic. The group also says that Reuters had reportedly been trying to get the video using a lawsuit under the Freedom of Information Act, had not as yet been successful. And as for the other side of this story, senior military officials telling NBC News this afternoon that they believe that the pilots were convinced that they were firing on armed insurgents. This happened in an area where U.S. soldiers had come under fire in the past. The pilots thought that they needed to take action. The Pentagon says that it sees no reason to investigate this any further and that there have been no calls for an investigation. They see no evidence of criminal intent or negligence in this particular case. Joining us now is Julian Assange. She is the co-founder of WikiLeaks. Also here today, Brett McGurk, former National Security Council staff member and Afghan policy expert, currently with the Council on Foreign Relations, Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, senior fellow and external communications director for the Center for Advanced Studies, and Glenn Greenwald, columnist, constitutional lawyer for Salon.com, joins us by way of Skype. Julian, I'll begin with you. How did you come to possess these tapes?
We specialize in having whistleblowers send us this sort of information. So we acquired it in a process like this. We never speak too directly about our confidential sources.
But you would point this to a military whistleblower, effectively?
Yes, there were more than one military whistleblowers involved in releasing this material and surrounding documents to us.
When
we first obtained the video itself, that was encrypted.
Do you have more tapes like this?
Yes, we do.
How many?
I won't go into the precise number, but there was a rumor that the tape we were about to release was about a similar incident in Afghanistan where 97 people were bombed in May last year. We have that video.
Do you intend to release that video as well?
Yes, as soon as we have finished our analysis, we will release it.
What is your intention in releasing these videos and acquiring these videos?
Well, we can see in this case, we really have unique material that shows how modern aerial warfare is done. It hasn't been revealed before. It also shows the debasement and moral corruption of soldiers as a result of war. It seems like they are playing video games with people's lives, and even the mission itself, although many may argue with the correctness of that mission, is thrown out the window. For example, when Saeed, one of the Reuters journalists, is lying prone on the ground. They may believe him to be an insurgent, but he clearly has no weaponry, no arms. There's no armed combat around him, and what appears to be good Samaritans who go to his aid are also clearly unarmed. If he was an insurgent, they genuinely believed him that he was an insurgent, that wounded man should be interrogated and asked about what he was doing. But instead, you can hear on the transcript, they're saying, come on, buddy, just pick up a weapon. All we need you to do is pick up a weapon, because under the rules of engagement, as soon as he picks up a weapon, he can be killed. So their desire is simply to kill as many people as possible, to get as high scores as possible in their endeavor to kill people and then brag about it to the rest of the troops. The mission itself is completely out the window.
Julian, please rejoin us again as you continue your efforts to document some of this coverage. Julian Assange, co-founder of WikiLeaks.
That clip, as we said, does go on with Anthony Schaefer and Glenn Greenwald. And Julian mentioned it's like a video game. Of course it is. And we're going to get to that in just a moment. Let me read down the list of the related updates on collateral murder. From Fox News, video appears to show U.S. forces firing on unarmed suspects in Baghdad. WikiLeaks co-founder talks to Russia Today on YouTube. Whistleblower report, leaked video shows U.S. cover-up, that's from Danger Room. WikiLeaks reveals proof of murder in Iraq, again from Russia Today. Video shows 07 air attack in Baghdad that killed photographer, that's from the New York Times. Iraq outrage over U.S. killing video, that's from Al Jazeera. The focus falls on WikiLeaks, that's from the Atlantic Wire. Gawker notes that WikiLeaks is better at finding classified Pentagon videos than the Pentagon is. No surprise there. But Jonathan Stray, writing for foreignpolicy.com, asks if this is the future of journalism. This week marked the international coming out party for a new media organization that could upend the sacred cows of traditional journalism. WikiLeaks, an internet-savvy investigative journalism outfit, released a video showing an American Apache helicopter open fire on a group of men, killing two Reuters employees along with 10 other people on July 12, 2007. There was no threat warranting a hail of 30-millimeter caliber gunfire from above, says Anthony Martinez, a former U.S. Army non-commissioned officer who has watched thousands of hours of aerial footage in Iraq. The video, seen through the perspective of the Apache gun camera, captures a dark moment in the Iraq War. As the American men chuckle over the body count, it also amounts to a damning indictment of war culture. No traditional journalism organization was able to bring it to the public, as these tapes are normally classified. Reuters filed a FOIA request, but never received a response. True to its promise to release complete source material, WikiLeaks has posted the full 38-minute gun camera video on YouTube, but the focus of its Monday press conference was an annotated 19-minute edited clip published on the site CollateralMurder.com. It opens with a quote from British provocateur slash journalist George Orwell. Political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give the appearance of solidity to pure wind. Is this the future of journalism? Is this why we see the web under attack? We've noted time and time again there is an I-9/11, an I-Patriot Act sitting on the shelf, waiting for an I-9/11, I should say. The catalyzing catastrophic event. Richard Clark and Professor Lawrence Lessig have both noted the I-Patriot Act. WikiLeaks just recently themselves disclosed a document from the military aimed at how to destroy WikiLeaks. I believe it's now 2+ years old, so fortunately they've not been successful. But the attacks are coming on a free and open web. And unfortunately, we've noted time and time again that unfortunately the military pretty much created the web, so... We also have Robert Gibbs, White House press secretary, and his response to collateral murder, which is, of course, go ask the Department of Defense about it. Salon, and again, Glenn Greenwald notes that the military can't find its copy of this Iraq killing video. More from News Junkie Post. Danger Room notes that the military released redacted records on this 07 Apache attack, but questions still linger. Again, doing great work, Glenn Greenwald notes that this Iraq slaughter is not an aberration. This isn't some, oh my God, I can't believe this one thing happened. It goes on and on and on. More from allgov.com. And again, this isn't your granddad's war. I didn't want those fuckers to run away and scatter, says the transcript. And it gets much worse than that. But there's a video put together where real life war crimes and video game war crimes are juxtaposed. It's a 7-minute clip, and the story from InfoWars, Violence in Video Games and the Baghdad Massacre. The video, Violence in Video Games, was produced to demonstrate the close similarities between real-world violence and simulated violence included in video games. The video juxtaposition scenes captured in the real world and those that exist in the fantasy game world depicted in the Call of Duty series. Shooting dogs, beating children, murdering innocent civilians are dwarfed by the amount of unmitigated evil game developers are having their heroes portray. Call of Duty, currently the most popular first-person shooter, bigger than Grand Theft, bigger than Halo. Current versions of the game have torture of captured enemy combatants, burning prisoners alive with Molotov cocktails, shooting soldiers who surrender, and the terrorist slaughter of civilians in a Russian airport. For the less gung-ho or psychopathic, latest versions of Call of Duty allow players to opt out of the scenes depicting the murder of innocent civilians. Video games play an important role in training U.S. soldiers as they prepare for combat. In 2008, the Army invested $50 million for the development of video games and a gaming system designed to train soldiers for combat. Quote, with the new platform and games, Army programmers hope to offer more lifelike reproductions of battlefield scenarios, offering editable terrains, a greater capacity for multiplayer action and larger battlefields, writes Switched, an AOL Electronics website. The current version of Call of Duty wasn't available in 07 when this massacre happened, But considering the way they act, you wouldn't know it. We should also mention America's Army was one of the games created by the military. I recently subscribed on Twitter to the WikiLeaks stream, twitter.com/WikiLeaks. And of course, it's been quite the hive of tweeting activity in this last week, as would be expected. But one from just about 19 hours ago, no links or anything, just an important note. Right-wingers should know we originated ClimateGate, Acorn censorship, and documents on Rezko Blagojevich corruption. Further breaking down the left-right paradigm. Our last note here is an update from Uruknet. WikiLeaks, the scourge of governments from China to U.S., will soon release a video related to another killing. From May of last year, scores dead after U.S. strike in Afghanistan. They're going to soon release a video related to this and more than 100... related to this killing of more than 100 innocent Afghan civilians in May 2009. This, of course, comes on the backdrop of this collateral murder release this week. Take note of what the U.S. were saying when the news broke last year of the casualties. Quote, "We do everything we can to avoid civilian casualties. When the insurgents embed themselves amongst the population, this makes it very difficult. But we ask our commanders to use proportionality and restraint, especially among the populated areas, and consider other options." This is a familiar accusation against Hamas in Gaza, but had been widely discredited by human rights organizations. It's easier to accuse the Taliban of this tactic because they have a stricter interpretation of Islam and therefore more evil. The release of these next videos will hopefully give us more answers. Unfortunately, we maybe suspect we know what they are. So as was mentioned in just that brief moment we heard with Julian Assange talking to Dylan Radigan, that they do have more videos. There is more to come. It's not going to stop. We're going to shift gears yet again and come to my current backyard. Of course, the first hour we covered my home state of West Virginia. But now we're going to move to a post on Media Monarchy called Oregon Oddities, Explosions, Protests, and Mustard Gas. This first article comes to us by way of HLSWatch.com. That's Homeland Security Watch. And it's called the Open Source Question. And this open source question centers around something known as the PDX boom. You may recall a few weeks ago, just a brief headline that we threw out to you. A strange, loud explosion heard in Portland a few weeks ago. And then it happened again. So going back to March 28th, so just a little bit of time. The open source question on the PDX boom. The open source intelligence debate took on new meaning on March 28th. Shortly after 8 p.m., a loud explosion shook houses all across the east side of Portland, Oregon. What ensued afterwards provides new insights not only into how intelligence is generated, but also illustrates some of the new challenges we face in managing the collection and analysis process. Within minutes, subscribers to the microblogging service Twitter had invented and agreed to use the hashtag PDXBoom to track reports. Within half an hour, the ad hoc collaboration started on Google Maps and was tracking and color-coding these reports in an effort to locate the source of the noise. And more than 20 wise guys had even created and logged into an event marking the occasion on the social networking site Foursquare using their wireless mobile devices. Just as a sidebar, you'll note that we referenced Foursquare recently on a story about a website called PleaseRobMe.com, where people were using, or a website rather, was showing people's tweets related to playing Foursquare, basically showing that they're far away from their home. PleaseRobMe.com. But I digress. Back to the PDX boom. The theories spawned by these efforts ran the gamut from the Sirius and Earthquake boom, as I speculated on Twitter, hashtag PDX boom, to precede an earthquake. It was discussed live on Ground Zero with Clyde Lewis. He is, of course, live on Sunday nights. Just after this took place, it was discussed briefly on the air. Again, back on March 28th. The theory spawned by these efforts ran the gamut from the Sirius and earthquake boom to the nonsensical unicorns fighting or a house falling on a wicked witch. But the map generated by the more serious reports painted a much more compelling picture of the event. Efforts by local officials and media outlets to isolate the source by consulting the National Weather Service, the local Air National Guard Fighter Wing, and NORAD, the U.S. Geological Survey, and various utilities likewise proved fruitless. Yet the public remained undeterred. Hundreds of people logged in over the next several hours to record their experiences of the event. Before long, some patterns became evident. The next day, aided by daylight, armed with these online contributions, information from the initial 911 reports, and information gathered following the previous incident, investigators located the site of the explosion along a riverbank near downtown. Fragments of a PVC pipe bomb were also recovered. What did we learn from this incident? Well, for starters, people want to be of assistance, even in a town where the police are not currently held in very high esteem due to the two recent officer-involved shootings / killings. Second, they'll seek out ways to make sense of confusing experiences, which more often than not include sharing their personal observations and perspectives in a way that gives them meaning, whether or not they can produce a plausible explanation. Finally, the speed with which this process of sharing information about our common experience advances will exceed anything we saw before the dawn of the information age. Now, while I don't agree with a whole lot that seems to be said in this article from HLSWatch.com, especially that people will seek out ways to make sense of confusing experiences, meaning if you don't accept an official conspiracy theory, well, I know folks have said, that sure was a pretty damn loud boom to be a PVC pipe. They said it was overcast, so that kept the sound waves in, so it radiated across the city. That could be true. And if all that's true, then what does that mean for Portland, if there are random pipe bombs being set off? Now, again, this article referenced Portland being a town where the police are not currently held in very high esteem due to two recent officer-involved shootings. Which brings us to the next part of this Oregon Oddities posting. There was a protest late Monday, and again, going back to now March 29th, there was another shooting a few weeks ago. A kid was killed by the cops. It was an African-American kid. Jesse Jackson shows up. Now, the second shooting happened, and I can't get into all the ins and outs and gory details. But again, Jesse Jackson shows back up. Second guy was white. Now, the question of someone like Jesse Jackson, I kind of believe he's kind of a made man as far as the world stage goes. There on the scene with MLK on the balcony at the Lorraine Motel. Did he get MLK to go outside? I'm not sure. If he did, on purpose or not, again, left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing, compartmentalization, I kind of see him as a made man. And it seems to be someone like Jesse Jackson's job to, again, basically divide and conquer. So there were massive, well, I won't say massive, there were protests in Portland. There's one amazing video from KVAL.com showing a protester throwing his bicycle at a cop on a bike. Now, the cops on the bikes, motorcycles rather, had been using them as cow catchers, if you will, bonking people along, shoving them out of the way. So you see someone pick up his bicycle and throw it at the back of a motorcycle cop. And this now reminds me of what Luke Radowski said recently at the Treason in America conference. Don't become that which you hate. And ultimately, all we're trying to do is be the change you want to see in the world. Getting into turf wars with the cops, I don't think is going to do it. And again, this is a discussion we're going to have a whole lot more. There was another event yesterday. Alex Ansari of Outside the Box, alexansari.com. Bullhorning downtown. I believe it's centered around a presentation being given at Portland State University called The Case for Socialism. And there is a great clip of Alex Ansari bullhorning what he called a stage-managed standoff between the quote-unquote black bloc and the cops. But going back to that March 29th protest, police union in Portland, their police union headquarters was vandalized in the early Tuesday morning hours.
We found some more damage that happened last night after the protest. Take a look at the Portland Police Association headquarters. It's all boarded up tonight. Scott Westerman with the police union tells us that just before 1 a.m., someone threw bricks and rocks through the windows. He estimated damage about $20,000. And it wasn't just the outside either. Computers and other items inside the office also damaged.
Now, again, thanks to my man Zach, an op-ed on portland.indymedia.org, a student's perspective on Monday's protest. Upset over the local media's portrayal of Monday's protesters, this student, Leah Gibson Blackfeather, writes her perspective of her involvement in the protest, where she starts, "On Monday evening, I was a student leaving my graduate level class to meet my boyfriend in the Smith Memorial Student Union. I was tired from a full day of work and then my first class of the term and just wanted to go home and relax. 4 hours later, I was being called a violent anarchist on all the major local news shows." She goes on to relate that story. And again, I'll say, I don't have the answers on this. We seem to have a lot of angry factions, even within all the groups that should agree with each other. Again, quoting Jello Biafra, I think it's why, or paraphrasing him, to not only not to hate the media, but to become the media, that's first and foremost, but that the reason the conscious and progressive left doesn't seem to be able to make any progress is because all the infighting and bickering, and I won't support you because you're not a vegetarian, or I'm not going to let you be at our show because I don't think you're punk enough. Meanwhile, the right, the supposed conservative right, they get in lockstep, tied in with the churches and the community organizations, and they win elections. So even within the dialectic, to which I would easily fall on the progressive side, I believe in fiscal conservatism and social liberalism. Ultimately, I think that whatever consenting adults want to put in or on or up themselves is their business. All drugs should be decriminalized and legalized. Prostitution, all of it. All those things. If you believe in personal liberties and responsibilities. But I'm totally digressing. We are going to see things heat up as the black bloc versus the Tea Party versus all these things start to escalate. And what we should probably do, and again, as I feel it, hopefully, as everything's kind of growing, and again, this feeling coming up in everybody seems to be causing a little bit of a wave in interaction here within the alternative media and my little, small, tiny, little sliver chunk of it on Media Monarchy. We should probably have another talk, and I know he's out there. We should probably have a talk with my man, Spencer, of ChicagoCopWatch.org. You may recall, probably over a year ago now, he was the first interview we had on MediaMonarchy.com. That would be a good conversation to have. So I'm throwing that out there right now. Because again, the more I learn, the more I know, I don't know. The last note here we want to hit on our Oregon oddities, explosions, protests, and mustard gas. From BioPrepWatch, another great news site. Army Depot worker exposed to mustard gas. A worker at Oregon's Umatilla Depot, that's U-M-A-T-I-L-L-A, a worker at Oregon's Umatilla Depot working to prep chemical weapons for destruction was injured recently by a mustard agent. The injury, which is believed to be the first exposure-related injury at the Umatilla Depot since it began the incineration of its chemical weapons stockpile in 2004, resulted in a small blister on the worker. The exposure is the third such exposure nationwide since the destruction of chemical weapons by the Army began in 1990. The incident, which was confirmed through urine samples, occurred when two workers were calibrating a scale that's used to weigh large storage tanks prior to tank incineration, Greg Mayhall, a materials agency spokesman, told OregonLive.com. Yes, to the east of Portland, Oregon, there is the Umatilla Depot, working diligently to somehow destroy and dispose of chemical weapons used in the quote-unquote Cold War. Again, in our backyard. That last bit doesn't exactly relate as much to the first two as far as the mysterious pipe bombs and the protests of people versus the police versus anything else. These are the discussions we're going to have more, my friends. So those were your Oregon oddities. We're now into the last half hour of the show, my friends, and we still have all the latest 9/11 updates, as well as BioWars and EnviroHealth. But what we're going to do now is police state updates. Threataganda and homegrown errorism under the police state's updates, rather. All the massive things that are going on. And again, just as this didn't start with Obama, it didn't start with Bush, it didn't start with any of the controlled left-right puppets. The assassination of JFK marked the last dire turning point. Massively slippery slope downhill ever since. They call that, you know, the loss of America's innocence, and it was, and so much more and worse. That seemed to be the point at which the war state, the secret, the families, the interlocking organizations and corporations and families that we talk about time and time again. Are they the Illuminati? There are definitely bloodlines. That's undeniable. And you'll find the very same ones throughout all our misleaders and puppets. All the world's a stage, like the man said. And we're seeing these things rise. Everything seemed to spike again, as we've noted, with the Christmas bomber. The completely debunked story of the shepherded Patsy Mutilop. But of course, there was the Fort Hood shooting not long before that. And again, we're going to be veering into, very soon, the scary time in April, when homegrown errorism events seem to happen. Columbine, Waco, Oklahoma City, Virginia Tech. So the big story over the last day or so, slightly. Qatari diplomat causes security scare on flight after smoking and joking. And then the plane was diverted to, of course, Denver's New World Airport. No surprise there. A Qatari, and that's from the country of Qatar, Q-A-T-A-R, A Qatari diplomat who caused a security alert aboard a United Airlines flight after smoking in a toilet will not be charged with a crime, an embassy rep said on Thursday. Qatar's ambassador to the United States called the incident aboard a flight from D.C. to Denver late on Wednesday a mistake and said the man who had diplomatic immunity was traveling on official business. He was caught smoking in a toilet and made a remark that was perceived as a threat on the plane. No smoking is, of course, allowed on commercial flights in the United States. He basically, and again, it's all in here. The article goes on and on. He got caught smoking in the toilet. And then made some joke of like, oh yeah, like I'm gonna fucking light some stupid shoe bomb or something. Boom, that's it. Off to New World Airport. With the New World Order murals painted below, the possible underground tunnels and bases. The pale horse. Standing watch outside. But the update on this from CBS is that the smoking Qatari diplomat was to meet a jailed terrorist. I'm sure as this goes on, we'll find the shady rogue networks of patsies and moles and double and triple agents. Texas pipe bomb suspect mad at the government, coming to us, of course, from Fox News. We also have the Associated Press. FBI arrests California man for threatening Nancy Pelosi. That's from the Associated Press, and we do have the video update where his mom blames Fox News.
Well, ABC 7 News I Team reporter Dan Noyes has been looking into Juicy's criminal history, and Dan, you managed to reach his mother as well.
Oh, we did, Carolyn. Dan, Juicy's 83-year-old mother hadn't heard that her son had been arrested. She told us he has a history of mental problems. He doesn't think he would be capable of carrying out the threat. He has never owned a gun. And she blames Fox News for getting her son worked up.
As Greg is, frequently gets in with a group of people that have really radical ideas and that are not consistent with myself or the rest of the family, and which gets him into problems. And apparently I would say this must be another one that somehow he's gotten onto, either by, I say, Fox News or all of those that are really radical, and he, that's where he comes from.
Juicy has a history of erratic behavior. In 2004, he was convicted of criminal threats. The San Mateo DA's office tells me he was trying to evade the fare on a Caltrain. The conductor tried to kick him off, and he started yelling and threatening his life. As a result, Juicy was sentenced to a year in county jail, 3 years supervised probation. He was also ordered to undergo mandatory mental health counseling. We also found this current lawsuit filed in February by Hamilton Square Baptist Church in San Francisco. It says, quote, Juicy has engaged in and continues to engage in a campaign of harassment against people at the church. Now, Juicy also has a record of skipping out on his BART fares and causing disruptions. BART even sued him back in 1996. He has two convictions in San Francisco, welfare fraud and petty theft from 1992. We asked ABC 7 legal analyst Dean Johnson about this latest charge. Where does free speech end and threats begin?
Communicating a threat with the intent that it be taken seriously is one of those types of speech that is simply not protected. Even under state law, as well as the federal law that applies here, there are crimes that are based on threatening another individual. You simply cannot do that.
Now, the mother, Eleanor Juicy, also told us she talked to her son earlier in the day. Apparently, before the arrest, he asked about his niece and his nephew and acted as though nothing was going on. The FBI tells me he'll spend the night in San Francisco County Jail and appear in federal court in the morning. Dan Carroll.
Those are troubled past, obviously.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it goes on from Examiner.com. Serial death threats against senator end with arrest of suspect. Charles Allen Wilson of Washington State was arrested and charged with threatening a federal official, according to a report submitted to the National Association of Chiefs of Police. The 64-year-old Wilson was arrested by the FBI and local law enforcement officers at his home near Yakima, Washington. Wilson became the subject of a federal investigation after a series of threatening phone calls to the office of Washington's U.S. Senator Patty Murray. Mentally unstable people on both sides and all sides of the political dog and pony show get provocateured into violence in a number of ways. And again, that's another discussion we're going to be having very much so. in the near future. And it goes on, the Scaranoia and Threataganda and Homegrown Errorism. LAX, security breach, delays flight. That's from azcentral.com. Bomb found in U.S. courthouse. That's from the spokesman.com. Not sure where that is centered. U.S. courthouse in Kansas City evacuated in false bomb scare. Anthrax threat against New York Representative Anthony Weiner traced to Brooklyn. More on that from, again, bioprepwatch.com. Greenpeace to global warming skeptics. We know where you live. Paul Joseph Watson brings this story to light, and of course Greenpeace has yanked that story before I was able to get a print of it. Surely someone got it. And this is how the selectively enforced agenda will go forward. The Green Police living inside of your head. And then another story on the Guardians of the Free Republics connected to a Texas radio station. I believe that's Republic Broadcasting. More on that from Christian Science Monitor. Will the feds use this letter sent by Citizen Group to stage more false flags? That's a question. NationalTerrorAlert.com, FBI probes resignation ultimatum letter sent to governors. ConspiringTimes.com, Restore America Declaration shakes up governors across America. Again, basically a letter saying, you guys have all failed, so you can either leave your office or you will be removed. I believe it was something to that effect. Military flyovers in Utica, New York on April 6th. NORAD fighters practice. If you see aircraft in the sky, don't worry. It's just an exercise. But we pay attention to the exercises. They sometimes have a nasty habit of turning live. Officers accused of tasering a 10-year-old boy. TSA letter confirms naked body scanners transmit images. Naked body scanners may not have thwarted alleged Christmas Day bomber, the GAO says. More on that from CNS News. Homeland Stupidity has completed an incident planning for a Moscow-like explosive attack. So again, the things they put into tabletop exercises and drills somehow seem to happen. U.S. trains buses vulnerable to terror attack, so says Lieberman. Although we know that more surveillance is happening and coming on planes and trains and cars and buses. Back to New York City, NYPD shifting anti-terror cops to the streets.
Hard hit by budget cuts, the New York City Police Department is taking a controversial step to fight a spiking murder rate.
Police officers used to scare off terrorists are being reassigned. CBS 2's political reporter Marcia Kramer with the story behind the shifting patrols.
Outside the Empire State Building, one of the top terror targets in the city, some New Yorkers were outraged by the shift.
He's getting down.
Yeah.
Why is that a bad thing? Because we might get bombed again? Yeah, so I definitely consider that that would be a bad thing.
Look, it is what it is. The budget and the economy in New York is bad. I mean, you got to make cuts. I'd rather it be there than, I guess, their teachers or something like that. I mean, you know, it's not good, but I mean, it's you're stuck between a rock and a hard place.
I think it's bad.
Why? I think it's because we have to get it protected. We have to be protected.
Bad decision, yeah. We still need to be up on that terrorist alert, and I think that he should take a second thought on it.
But face budget cuts that risk turning the NYPD blue into the NYPD few. Up to 20% of the cops assigned to guard city landmarks and scare terrorists are being shifted to crime patrols. I asked the mayor if any terror targets would go uncovered.
We think that we have coverage where it should be, but it's the sort of thing, unless you put a cop in front of every building 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you can always have done more, and that's not the reality.
The anti-terror cops are being reassigned to cope with surging crime rates. Murder up 22% so far this year, shootings up 19%. The police department says it's not the first time it shifted the terror squad to other duties, but it comes as the department has undergone a huge drop in manpower. The number of cops have plummeted from nearly 41,000 in the year 2000 to 35,000 now, and it could drop to somewhere in the 32,000 range if the mayor doesn't get help from Albany. The final decision on potential cuts to the police department won't be made until the city budget is adopted at the end of June. At City Hall, I'm Marcia Kramer, CBS 2 News.
If Mayor Bloomberg has to make the threatened cuts to the police department, headcount would be at its lowest since 1990 when crime in the city was out of control. Back then, Mayor David Dinkins imposed a tax to hire more police officers.
So we see, again, that all crime is terror. That's what Section 802 of the Patriot Act says. That's why they're moving terror cops to the streets, because they know that as the rug continues to be pulled out from under you, financially, and even mentally and consciously, a lot of folks, mentally unstable or not, are going to crack. And again, we must not crack. We must not go violent. Don't turn into the thing that you hate. Be the change that you want to see in the world. Former Miami Beach cop charged by the FBI with kidnapping and extortion. Illinois CIA staffer gets jail for fake reports. CNN touts Civilian Service Corps as a way of shedding student debt. Again, your job will be with the state. Parliament Hill Mounties getting submachine guns. Small army to protect Toronto during the G20 summit coming up, I believe, in June. Mexican assassin teams may target U.S. law enforcement. And the last note, on some kind of bright note, the Easter Bunny targets photo radar cameras in Tempe, Arizona.
The Easter Bunny, hard at work for the past 24 hours. In addition to his usual duties, he's apparently targeted photo radar cameras in Tempe. ABC 15's Tim Betcher shows us how the bunny managed to shut one of the cameras down for hours.
Here comes Peter Cottontail, hopping down the bunny trail.
Before he headed out to hide eggs across the valley, the Easter Bunny spent his Saturday night hiding a photo radar camera in Tempe.
It's all a scam.
Shelton videotaped the prank and then uploaded it to YouTube.
We was walking down University Rural, and I heard there was going to be an Easter Bunny going down there, so I figured I'd go tape him.
The 90-second clip shows someone dressed in a costume walk up to a red light camera at the intersection of Rural and University in Tempe. The bunny, who Shelton won't identify, takes a giant egg and places it over the camera, rendering it useless.
The Easter Bunny, I guess he was hopping mad about the fraud going on, about the photo radar, so he hopped around and it took this big egg and stuck it on top of the photo radar scanner.
Back in December of 2008, people dressed as Santa Claus pulled a similar prank also in Tempe. Drivers we spoke with support the shenanigans.
I think it's pretty funny, actually.
Yeah, don't lie.
Well, I don't know. It'd just be kind of humorous. I'd like to have seen it in person.
I think it's kind of funny. You know, the cameras are kind of annoying.
Tempe police, however, aren't laughing, calling such behavior criminal damage. But Shelton says it'll continue until the cameras come down.
If the legislators would actually do their job, then the Easter Bunny wouldn't have to go out and do this kind of thing.
The egg covered the photo radar camera for a good 5 to 6 hours last night, but it has since been removed.
Culture jamming. Monkey wrenching the New World Order, again, only becoming more and more and more important. The surveillance cameras will be tied into the smart grid, the control grid. They're also used to wring nickels and dimes out of you. As we mentioned on the previous episode, states are ravaging, killing the motorists with tickets. The massive sweeps, 7,000+ tickets given away in Virginia recently. These kind of actions only become more important. Quickly, let's blast through the BioWars EnviroHealth updates. Infection, detection, pollution. Obama to crush economy with massive CO2 taxes beginning as early as next week. That's from Canada Free Press. Dr. Jack Castle refuses to treat Obama supporters. That's from the Huffington Post, and you can see the photo posted up on his door. He put the sign that said, if you voted for Obama, seek urologic care elsewhere. Changes to your health care begin right now, not in 4 years. Pfizer ordered to pay up over AIDS-like virus infections, and again, the lawsuit of a ex-employee infected with the mysterious things that happen in the pharma labs that, again, just somehow happened to escape. More on that from Raw Story. Pfizer's bad week, kickbacks, whistleblowers, and doctors on the payroll from allgov.com. Bayer beats out Exxon for the most toxic corporate air polluter title. Dispatch Politics, bacteria detection is anti-terror effort. Pentagon beefs up biosecurity. Government may have to waste millions of H1N1 vaccines. Tularemia detected in Ohio air. NASA getting $2.5 billion for climate change research. Baja earthquake 7.2. Major earthquake strikes Sumatra, Indonesia. Anthrax scare leads to evacuation of 2 Texas schools. And lastly, you can't make this up, genetically engineered enviro pig waiting for approval in U.S. and Canada. Brave New World Order. We're going to close out with 9/11 updates. Polls, ports, recants, and remains. 100 million question, or at least find fault, with the official 9/11 story. More on that from signsofthetimes.net, SOTT.net. Port Authority seeks new homes for WTC 9/11 steel. U.S. recants claim that detainee, who was a main source for the 9/11 report and was repeatedly tortured, was involved in 9/11 or even Al-Qaeda. Abu Zubaydah, they've backed away from it. We'll see that on the front of the newspaper. The war of terror is a fraud. And we have the story that we hit briefly last week, and it's the way we're going to wrap up this time. And we've got reporting from 9/11 blogger and the BBC. But again, Russia Today, featuring Manny Badillo. And the real story on New York City's quote-unquote return to the sifting of 9/11 human remains.
There were 2,000 in those mass graves. Meanwhile, nearly 3,000 lives perished in the September 11th terrorist attacks in the U.S. Now, more than 8.5 years later, New York officials are beginning a new search for the remains of those killed. But why now? Joining me live to talk about the new search from our New York studio is Manny Badillo, who lost a family member himself in 9/11. Thank you for joining us. Now, what's your reaction to this new investigation?
It's really a continuation, as opposed to an investigation. There's been an ongoing sifting of material that's been worked on down at Ground Zero. Every time down at Ground Zero that they're taking out new equipment, putting in new equipment in, taking out rubble. The New York City coroner, there's a coroner there every day. Mm-hmm. Any body fragments that are found that they could look at, they could take out, and they could bring up to the chief medical examiner's office. And all the material around it is essentially sifted through already at Water Street in Brooklyn. There's nothing new about this process at all. It's outrageous. It's incredible that the media has portrayed this as something benevolent on the part of the government. We've been doing this the entire time in Brooklyn, in Water Street. All we're doing is moving the process over to Fresh Kills Landfill, where there are hills of debris that the city refuses to go through. There you will find many body fragments, body parts, and forensic evidence of the case. So to hear that the media had said that this is an investigation, really it's just a continuation of an ongoing process that has been going on for years.
Well, why has it taken nearly 9 years to get to this pile of debris that you're talking about?
Well, what happens is that during this construction, notice how there's no construction of a memorial down at Ground Zero. There's already been a building built, a new building 7 has been built, but the pit, that square pit that we're all familiar with, is still a crime scene. You still have body fragments, body parts that are still being found, not just within the pit, but all around the area. So what you have is you have the New York City Chief Medical Examiner's there every day. They're taking the larger body parts, but what you find is there's a lot of material that still needs to be sifted through in case there is body fragments there. That's done in Brooklyn right now. All the city is saying is it's propaganda. It's a definition of it. They're saying that, okay, we're going, moving this to Fresh Kills so we can look for body fragments for 9/11 victims. Listen, it's been outrageous how they've been treating the family members and the victims of 9/11. The city is just not doing the right job yet again. We should be not only looking for body fragments, not just at the material that's being recovered at Ground Zero, still through the ongoing construction, but we should be also looking for other forensic evidence, and especially the iron-rich spheres and the red gray chips that have been found within the debris of the World Trade Center that tell a very different story than what we heard from our government.
Okay, now we have heard some reactions from the 9/11 Truth Movement about this investigation. Some think that there's more behind it, like what you're talking about, that's in addition to recovering the remains of victims. Do you agree?
Yeah, I've heard that too. I will say that there has been a lot of talk as to why the New York City government is saying that we're going to be now newly sifting a process that's already been taking place. What concerns me is that perhaps they're actually going to be moving this process to Fresh Kill so they can go through that material and maybe even confirm for themselves what independent scientists have found, the highly engineered military-grade explosives in the debris of the World Trade Center. Perhaps they'll find that. Perhaps this is just data collection. But essentially, this news is another way for the government to distract us from some of the very real issues. Why is there no trial yet? There has been close to 100 family members that have brought litigation against against the government, the small majority that did not take the hush money from the government for 9/11. Why hasn't there been one trial? Judge Alvin Hellerstein has been a huge roadblock to justice and accountability on that day. Just recently, he argued that there's not enough money to cover the first responders. That's right, there's not enough money. It's going to cost billions and billions of dollars to help the rescuers, the heroes of that day, who are dying today, not only based on the lies, but because of the forensic evidence that's in their lungs, that's found at Fresh Kills, that's being found in the debris of the World Trade Center still, at the construction site, at the crime scene. We need to address this fully and not just have some press release that the city government is trying to let the family members know we're on your side.
All right. Well, Mr. Badillo, thank you for joining us. Thank you for raising those questions. And sounds like there's a lot more that needs to be answered beyond this investigation that's beginning in a new area on Monday.
My friends, we're literally running out of time. This has been episode 165 of MediaMonarchy.com for April 9th, 2010. I hope you enjoyed my very personal investigation into the situation in West Virginia, and remind you to stay tuned for our just confirmed upcoming interview with Reverend Billy on bringing the mountains to the banksters. All that and so much more. Stay tuned to MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show. As always, telling you, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
The Thought Police would get him just the same.